Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success. Gas mark 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm gonna cook a meal that's gonna make you mine. I'm turning up the oven, now we're ready to roast. When you taste behind it, you'll love it the most. Come on and put me in your loving shoes.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Chino Moyer. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hello, Stuart. Thanks a lot for having me in your show.
My pleasure. Now, my first job after watching your film was to look up what an undergod was, because I wasn't sure if it was a real word or not. And I was surprised to learn that it is a low or inferior god, a subordinate deity, a demigod, which I'd never appreciated. So thanks for introducing me to that concept.
Yeah.
Now, before we go into details about your film, do you want to give people a brief synopsis as to what Undergods is about?
Yeah, it's Undergods is an anthology film. It's a genre film, combines a bit of science fiction with other genre elements like thriller and horror. But and it's basically a movie about failed societies. It's a movie about failed societies and the failed individuals that are bred by this. But those societies. And it's a collection of stories. Each collection takes place in a different world, in a different, let's call it, dimension. And it's a bit of a journey through these worlds. And the movie, in a way, even though there are a few different stories, it operates as a single journey.
Oh, yeah, no, without a doubt. Certainly my experience, it was only really looking back that I even felt that you would call it an anthology like you did in your introduction, because I feel it works as a feature.
Yeah, to be honest, I started calling it more an anthology later as a way of, you always need some kind of taglines. When you pitch stuff. I never felt it. I always felt that it was just a single journey, yeah.
Because it operates in a similar way to, say, Richard Linklater's Slacker, in the sense of you change who the protagonist is. That's the only reason it becomes an anthology.
Yeah, exactly. So the story kind of morphs into other stories, but it's always this one almost journey in which, yeah, you. Sadly, at one point, one character leads into another, and that character takes us into another story, and so it's less of a. It was always intended of telling, making a movie with different stories, but all fitting into this one sole narrative.
Yeah, it's definitely one. Despite the different universes, it's definitely one story universe that I felt like I was watching.
Yeah,
what was the kernel of the idea that you sort of got that started you on the journey that become undergods?
Yeah, I guess in a way, probably I wanted to make a comment of comment about our society, our world, our the idea of all these humans creating these very complex societies that they are not able to control and that ultimately fail them. And it was a vision, I guess, that has to do a lot in the world where we live in, and obviously after what we've gone in the last year, it's even more clear that this system or this current system is not really working in terms of providing well-being for the individual. And that was, I guess, the main idea of making a movie about failed societies, and also about broken masculinity and how these male-dominated societies are not only failed in general for humans, but also they ultimately breed this kind of absolutely broken male and mainly broken white male, which are the people who tend to control these societies.
Yes, yes. There's a whole heap of evidence now, isn't there, going back centuries that that we're failing each other, but for the few that seem to benefit, we keep the system going.
Exactly. Which, weirdly enough, when I started the movie, there was a thing about, a movie about white male and white middle-aged men, and it was less topical, and then the more we moved into production and stuff, there was a lot of conversations about the topic, and now it's obviously it blew up in the last few years, especially this one after the protests and the Black Lives Matter movement. And but that was something that was clearly
Mr. Trump has done a lot to prove the point, hasn't he?
That was the thing, and in a way, this movie got financed right after Trump won the election,
okay.
And he was very beneficial for us, weirdly enough, because he winning, not directly.
I appreciate,
Donald Trump gave us the money, which could have been interesting. But when he won, a lot of people who were considering this movie, they suddenly got back to us and said, "Now I think we understand the what you want to say with this movie," and it helped us a lot. Trump's like winning the elections for people to understand what we wanted to say and what was the movie about.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just looking at the extensive list of producers on the project, and I noticed Katrine Kisser, who is a producer I interviewed as part of the Inside Pictures program last summer.
Oh, yeah. Kisser was in the project from a very early start. Was one of the producers who was involved from, she's also a good friend with Sophie, and she was amazing. We got money, public money from Estonia. We also shot some bits in Estonia. We had some Estonian crew and cast. We were all amazing. Kisa was great. Kisa was a co-producer who's been always very supportive of this movie, and she's still around. She's been always part of Under Gods from the very earliest start.
Yeah, no, I mean, and having seen your film and having spoke to her, it's interesting because one of her things is trying to solve the conundrum of making interesting cinema but being commercial as well, which is always the fight, isn't it?
Exactly. I guess it's not an easy one. And to be honest here, I think because we got a lot of public funding, I knew that I could take some liberties that I may not be able to take in future projects if I have to rely less on public funding and more in private investment or the budget is a bit bigger. Yeah.
So when you were writing it and you've got these like sort of parallel worlds, as it were, let's call them that, how did you wrestle with the rules of your story universe, you know, because that's what makes it so satisfying to watch, is it the continuum feels like it all fits together like a jigsaw, although while it's being built you don't see the whole thing being built.
Yeah, there was a lot of background story of this world. So there was I wrote a background story of this world, especially the more alternative science fiction ones, and how they originated, what happened, how humans ended up building those, and so there was a lot of back history, and I think that helped a lot. Not only me when I was developing these worlds and the script and filming them, but also the rest of the crew to understand the rules and when the set designer was designing the sets, when the costume designer was designing the costumes, even the actors when they were preparing for the roles, we talk a lot about those. And I think yeah, so most of the stuff that was in the backstory is not, it didn't end up being on the screen, but I think it helped a lot to bring together and to give some sense of reality or make those worlds more believable.
I love that aspect of screenwriting, that it's not about everything that's on the page and therefore everything that'll be on the screen, but gaining an understanding of someone's motivation helps if it's written down somewhere else. It's quite abstract when you think about it, but it also makes sense.
Yeah, it's strange. Even with the characters, the characters, there was this very long biographies. I remember with Kay Dickey once, because yeah, there was something about she having seen her husband, I don't know, some time frame, something that happened for a space of 10 years. 7 years, and she came back to me, but that was not on the script at all. And she came back to me once, like, I think she should have spent 10 years doing this instead of 7, as it is in your biography, which is, it was completely relevant to the script because it was never, that period of her life was never going to be talked about. But obviously it was something that for her was very important to create her character. And I think all these kind of details somehow they helped everyone, and also they got involved, especially the actors. Some of them also they got involved in. I gave them some biographies, but we rewrote them together. Some of them, I think those things they help grounding characters, worlds, stories a lot. And in fact, it's this. I'm writing something new, and I've done a lot of even more background stuff even before I started writing it, because I've learned through Undergods how important it is to create background stories and biographies.
Now, Ned Dennehy is one of my favourite actors. I don't know if you saw last year's Calm with Horses. He's fantastic in it. And the character of Harry who he plays is obviously very peculiar, and certainly more peculiar as we reveal more about him. But can you, and to be honest with you, it felt like it was playing against type, you know, what I'm used to seeing Ned play. This wasn't a character I'm used to seeing him play. It was a lot more kind of calm and understated. The emotions were very much below the surface, as opposed to the kind of more visceral or emotional characters I've seen him play in the past, which is, you know. What for you did he bring to the character when you start rolling the camera that when you were writing it on the page you couldn't have imagined? How did it come alive for you in Ned?
He brought a lot. I think Ned understood Harry very well, like really well from the very beginning. He really understood who that character was. And in fact, some of the best lines of that character actually came from him.
Oh, wow.
Were not on the script. Some of them end up being on the script, but after we did rehearsals and then I wrote them. But some of the best lines actually came from him. I think he really understood that character very well, and he brought a lot. I knew he was gonna be great, but as we started filming, it was amazing. It was amazing how he manipulated that married couple. And how much he brought into the character that was not necessarily on the page, and especially also, yeah, some brilliant pieces of dialogues, which in fact are some of my favorite dialogues on the film. I have to say, I didn't I actually didn't write them myself, came from Ned. They are all other dialogues that I also like a lot who I wrote, but some of my favorites actually are.
As the director, did you make it clear you were open to suggestion?
Yeah, with all the actors, I said, when we were doing rehearsals, I said, please feel free to bring anything you want. Please feel free to keep on adding sentences. So we did we were rehearsing of what was on the page, but we were allowing some space for improvisation also in the rehearsals. And that was very good. That helped a lot. A lot of things came out of those kind of moments of improvisation with a lot of the actors. So I was always very open for the actors to bring us as much as they wanted. There's some actors who love who prefer to work under more restrictive conditions. Some they like to improvise. My experience with Under Gods is like, there's some actors who are, doesn't mean that they are better or worse, because some of the ones they strictly follow what was on the page were amazing, and some who were more free were equally. So it's different methods, but I was definitely allowing everyone and inviting everyone to add as much as they wanted into the script.
A little tiny piece of information I'd like to ask, because it just struck me as, I think it's the first scene or the second scene when we're with Kate Dickie and their family before a man returns, as it were. Are they watching Extra on the television?
Yes, they are. I'm so glad at least someone I have to say, I mean, always, because initially we had one of the very gory, when he becomes a monster on TV. And I thought, maybe this is going to become too gimmicky. And then we end up with something that was more just a dramatic scene that could be from any film. Mm. But then I've always been half regretting, half not. But now, since someone has finally say that, yes, they were watching Extra. In fact, the names of Rachel, Will, and Sam, which are the names of the characters of that story, come from Extra. It's a homage to Extra.
Fantastic. I had the producer of Extra on the podcast when they did the 35th anniversary of Extra.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
wow. Yeah.
Extra is a movie that I saw when I was 7 years old in the cinema. There were different times.
Yeah, and different times indeed.
My dad took me to see it. I was 7 years old, and I chose it because my dad was not interested in horror at all. So it was probably my choice, and it blew my mind. And since then, it stayed. And it was quite a big influence in Under Gods.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, there's parallels between Kate Dickie's family story and
returns home. So the third story is really very, very inspired in Extra in many ways.
And obviously the husband who replaced the guy that returns is, I guess, in a way, while he's a victim of what happens, he's also one of your, I guess, your biggest exponents of the toxic masculinity.
Exactly.
Because his words are all about, to Kate Dickie's character, hold on, who pays for this house? Who goes to work? As if she's done nothing for the family.
Exactly. He was, and there was this, Dominic is definitely the epitome of broken and toxic masculinity. And then it was very interesting, the dynamics between the two, which is something that you have in Extra, is when the husband returns and there's already the new partner, husband of the wife, and all the kind of, all the conflict and tension between them. So that was definitely something really interesting, and I'm really glad that someone picked it up. Yeah.
Well, you're in good company here. You're in good company here with that sort of choice. What's fascinating is the way that Kate Dickie, the minute he shows his true hand, i.e., whatever his version of love is, it makes her decision to try and accept the return of the old partner into a life easy. And so the conversations become so much, and this new character of Rachel, this new Rachel is born right in front of our eyes almost.
Yeah, I think at that point she becomes really deluded and she started living, she begins to live some kind of fantasy. And obviously, as the biography, the idea was like she was never, Sam was the love of her life. Then he disappeared. So he ended up marrying this other guy, but out of almost convenience, he needed to survive somehow. So when Sam returns, he's so absolutely not who he used to be. And the only thing she can do, Rachel, at that point is start deluding herself. And I think there's something that happens where people delude themselves too much, that they end up being overly upbeat and optimistic, because this is the only way they have to try to lie to themselves.
Well, we've seen it a lot during COVID. You know, people have chosen some decision, and even when they're proved wrong, they stick with the decision they've chosen, because that, for some reason, it's worse to say I was wrong.
Exactly, and it's exactly that same of that type of decision and that type of you see it in politics all the time.
Yeah,
when Sally is these people, this way of infusing like a lot of optimism. I mean, Donald Trump was also a perfect example as well of infusing a lot of extra doses of optimism in order to make everyone believe and for you to believe something that is a blatant lie. And that's what happens to Rachel. She becomes super optimistic and is like, okay, this is going to work. Everything is going to be great. But obviously, it's clear that this guy is not the same.
Now, one of the visually astounding things about your movie is the dystopian sort of desolation of the urban, the decayed urban environments that you show. Then you shot on location in Estonia and Serbia. Am I right?
Yeah.
Is what we see all real, or is any of it sort of in? Have you enhanced any of it with CGI? Or
it's all enhanced.
Okay.
It's all very enhanced, in fact.
Okay, go on, tell me how.
So basically, it's all enhanced, but the locations were striking.
Okay.
So we spend a lot of time looking for these communist buildings, and both in Estonia and in Serbia. In Serbia, there's this whole parallel city called New Belgrade, which was built under communism, and they built it from scratch. There were some marshes, they drained the marshes and they built this. And it has these amazing streets, avenues, housing projects, industrial states. But the problem of most of those buildings, and the same, we found some really interesting locations in Estonia, but the problem is that those places are functioning streets. So you have traffic lights, you have cars parked, you have, and in places like in Estonia, which was Estonia, so cleaned up. Estonia has a lot of these communist buildings, but everything has been cleaned up, repainted, renewed. So you have the structure of the buildings, but everything feels quite modern. Plus also you have all these elements from our real life. So basically what we did is we used those locations, we shot in those locations. Then in post-production, we cleaned everything that was related to modern life. So we remove, we paint out all the cars, the traffic lights, the street signs.
Wow, everything. Really?
Yeah, which was a painstaking.
I bet.
It took a lot of time. And once we did that, we started aging all those buildings, breaking them down, creating cracks in the walls, in the roads, on the buildings, and then some of them and then extending a lot of them, just adding new buildings next to them. And for that, we have an amazing Estonian concept designer who designed how the cities will look on the... like on top of the actual photos or still lives from stills from the movie. she created these cities. And so then we gave them that to Filmgate, who did also an amazing job, and they made them real. So it was a lot of work, to create those cities in.
But it's essentially the thing that sells your film in many senses. You're using CGI almost like cutely, because it's not extravaganza in the sense of moving, but it's completely augmenting reality as far as what we're watching.
It was pretty much that, some form of augmented reality, because the locations themselves were striking. The buildings were amazing, the architecture, the geometry, the perspectives.
The birthday party scene, which is obviously a lot more contained than the idea of the cityscapes, the whole singing of My Way is a spectacular moment and a great reflection of one man's victory, you know, the boss surrounded by friends, and it's Dominic, isn't it? The character Dominic's life just falling apart after, and obviously getting himself drunk. What does that? I mean, I'm fascinated as a screenwriter. What does that look like on the page, and how do you translate that into a sequence? Because it's spectacular.
I was very positively, because especially when you write something that involves a song and a very specific song, it's like, how is this gonna? I have no. Yeah, and then when Bernd Gorman, which we didn't rehearse that scene at all, so Bernd suddenly got the mic. It's the same as we were saying with Ned. To be honest, it's the same as with all the actors. Somehow, Bernd knew that character very well. He knew it in a way. I remember we were filming, and he said, "I need a glass. I need a short glass. I need a white liquor and just two eyes." And he needed that prop. He knew who that character was very, and he was asking for specific things that he needed to perform that
That's
character.
Interesting.
And when he grabbed the mic, he was like, wow. Like, and it was amazing that scene worked so well. And obviously that song is, again, is so much about male and this male fantasy of the one way, and I did it my way, and it actually came up. Yeah, I have a little bit of a Trumpian uncle who's a very nice guy, very funny, but yeah, has some Trumpian elements to him, and he sang it in some kind of Christmas, family Christmas, and I saw him singing it. It's like, I think this will be perfect for Under Gods, because it expresses so much. All the characters and Bernd, yeah, brought it to another level, and also Dominic. There was something about the boss and the employee, this sort of weird twisted dialogue between them as they were singing. That I think for me, that's the moment where it's a very important moment in the film. I think that's
for
one
sure.
of the moments where I think it's the movie comes together in it.
Yeah, because you've given us all of your kind of misdirects, I suppose, in terms of what the resolution's going to be, and just in this moment, it's beginning to make sense. Although you're not quite sure how it's all going to fall, but certainly it isn't going to be bringing Dominic along with it, is it?
Yeah, and definitely, as you say, I think that's the moment where everything clicks, and all the rest that you've seen is come together in some way. Yeah.
One last question before we finish. The artwork for the poster is just beautiful. Who's responsible for that?
Do you mean the one with this sort of mannequin?
They're sort of almost like...
So there's this guy called Max Höfler. He's German. I grew up with a lot of... my dad had a lot of science fiction books at his house when I was growing up. And they all had this very specific technique, this airbrush technique, which I think it was similar to, they did a lot of that in Britain as well. And there was a particular style in the late 70s and early 80s for science fiction books of applying this. They used to always design with this kind of airbrush technique. So I really wanted to the poster that emulated those books. And then I did some research of people who did that technique. And Max Hoeffler, I think, is one of the masters of that. So we got in touch and he came up with some ideas. Then we did a bit of back and forth and he created that poster, which I think is stunning. Yeah.
No, I mean, it does a lot of the heavy lifting for your film before you sit down to watch it. You kind of know what you're getting into.
Yeah. So he did a great job. We are actually working with some other artists and we're going to be producing some alternative artwork that we'll be releasing soon, which is also really amazing.
That's exciting.
We're working with also like from a very, very different backgrounds and they're all creating some very exciting artwork.
Well, look, it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving us your time on the Britflix podcast.
And thanks a lot, Stuart. It's been a pleasure to chat with you, yeah.
Dad?
Yeah?
Will you read me a story?
Of course.
Do you promise you'll remember the monsters?
Promise.
What is this place?
Do you believe in God, Mr. Hulse?
So let's have a party, everybody.
This is extraordinary.
Years bringing darkness into my life. I can hear my inner voice now. Do you know what it's saying? Get Dominic out of the house.
It's a boring story.
Have some patience. It hasn't finished yet.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.